You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When it was enacted in 1919, Herbert Hoover called Prohibition a noble experiment intended to usher in a healthier, more moral, and more efficient society. But noble or not, very soon its consequences came as a shock to the whole country. And New York was a target of the drys, but as it turned out, drinking didn't decline in the Big Apple. It increased rapidly. Michael A. Lerner, an associate dean of studies at the Bard High School Early College, has written a history of the 18th Amendment, its impact and legacy. Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City is published by Harvard University Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
What forces got the 18th Amendment enacted?
Well, it had been building up for a long time. You know, there really was a problem with alcoholism and alcohol abuse in the United States. And this is a movement that, you know, Americans had been having this argument for 100 years or longer over alcohol. I think finally the things that put it over the edge were the combination of the progressive movement, this idea that progressives could really solve any problem that was out there in society, and then combine that with the effects of World War I, which in effect made this a national security issue. Those two things came together. And that was that combination of forces put prohibition in the Constitution.
How a national security issue?
When the war was in effect, you could make the argument, and the Drys made the argument very effectively, that you had no business wasting grain and fuel on things like beer and whiskey if there's a war going on. You needed to conserve your resources, that soldiers needed to be sober, that everyone should be sacrificing something for the war effort. So you got, and you silenced your opponents as well. The German element was seen as a threat to the United States, and since most brewers were of German descent, it was a great way to demonize them and shut them up.
In fact, there's an awful lot of anti-immigrant sentiment within this whole thing, and we'll get to that a little later. The leading group pushing for prohibition was the Anti-Saloon League.
Right.
Who were they?
A very well-organized, well-funded, and very efficient group of lobbyists based in Ohio. Not the stereotypical, I think Americans think of temperance activists, and they think of, you know, the little old ladies with the Bibles running around. These were lawyers, lobbyists, public relations experts, really progressives coming out of a business model, coming out of a very well-versed in law and politics, and they were the ones who organized the movement.
What were their motives? Some people have suggested that the Anti-Saloon League is a forebear of today's religious right.
I think there are a lot of similarities. I don't think it's an exact matchup, but I think the tactics certainly bear a resemblance. And it's this idea that one group in society, a very well-leveraged minority group, can really impose its agenda on a compliant political, in this case Congress, and get the rest of the country to go along with something.
Well, because there's also a moral component to this whole thing, isn't
yes.
there? It goes beyond simply saying that alcohol is a health risk.
Yeah, there's always a moral component. These issues tend to bring together, there's an overlap of public health concerns, moral concerns, but it's the other people's morality that concerns them.
Is that why New York City was a prime target?
Absolutely.
For the drys?
Yeah. It was seen as an immoral city. It was seen as an un-American city. It was a place where those other people lived, and they needed to be brought in line with what other people viewed as the American way of life.
Other people being Catholics, Jews, Eastern Europeans?
Blacks, Puerto Ricans, Greeks, Italians, go down the list.
And then also it had fancy restaurants. It had theaters.
Sure.
And it seemed to be more tolerant than other cities.
New York was, I think most American cities had to have some level of tolerance. I mean, they don't function if you don't accept the diversity that's in them. So, yeah, New York was a place where sort of a different set of rules seemed to be in effect.
What was New York's response to the Anti-Saloon League's campaign.
I was really surprised working on the book that initially New Yorkers were a little more open-minded about it than I expected. Some of them were optimistic. They did see some of the logic behind the argument for prohibition. Some of them said, let's give this a chance. New York State did ratify the amendment, much to everyone's surprise.
With a strong support from the city? Or
not strong support upstate? From the city, but there were certainly people in the city who supported it. The Dries could find enough New Yorkers to go along with this to say this is not, you know, New Yorkers are not opposed to this entirely. The president of the Women's Christian and Temperance Union, Ella Boole, was from Brooklyn. So, you know, there were certainly New Yorkers who were on board with the Dry movement.
Although, as time went on, many of the people who had supported them changed their minds.
Yeah, they changed their minds very quickly.
And you point out that this temperance movement brought together some unlikely alliances, like Norwegian church groups and African-American labor activists.
Sure. The Dry movement was so effective in presenting their argument that up to the ratification, and I guess maybe even in the early year or two of Prohibition, they could find people who had common ground with them, people who could say, yes, there are real arguments to be made here about protecting working class families, about cleaning up neighborhoods, about the corruption that went along with saloons and their influence in politics. So people did find some places to sort of come together with the Dry movement. But I think the real nature of Prohibition came out as the experiment unfolded.
The point man in New York was William Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
He was from Maryland. What else can we say about him?
Originally from Michigan, a lawyer, very effective. He had sort of gotten the promotion to come to New York and try and get Prohibition on the books here after cleaning up Baltimore. Baltimore was a formidable opponent for the Anti-Saloon League to begin with, and he ended up closing, I think, over half the saloons in Baltimore. He was seen as someone you didn't want to mess with, and so the Anti-Saloon League sent him to New York. And he went right to work. He really sort of exemplifies the no-nonsense lobbyist. He didn't pull any punches. He scared people to death.
Did he convince people or just scare them?
I think he scared them more than convinced them. He certainly angered a lot of New Yorkers with his heavy-handed tactics, but especially in Albany, in the political world, people really were worried that this guy meant business.
Did the Anti-Saloon League make a big mistake when it appointed him to run its New York operation? Because, as you say, he was opinionated. He was kind of motor-mouthed. Also, he was bigoted, which didn't play as well in New York as it might have in some other places.
Well, I found doing the research that the bigotry that was embedded in the Dry movement really seemed to come out of frustration. It unveiled itself when the movement started to fail and it became more pronounced. So I don't think that would have been something that they were thinking about too much in sending him to New York. They really just saw an effective lobbyist who could get the job done.
Well, he defended the KKK.
He did later. Yes.
Is the bigotry of a racial nature, or more of a class nature, of
it's,
a religious
it's a
nature?
Racial, ethnic, religious, all of those things together.
So this is a kind of an America first thing, as much as it is a concern about whether people drink and commit crimes.
Sure, it's that you can't separate the two. It's a sense that Catholics and drinkers are the same thing. And you have to curb the influence of them in lots of different arenas.
So we wind up with a battle between immigrants and old stock Americans, between Catholics and Jews against Protestants.
Right.
Proponents of civil liberties against advocates of societal reform.
Yeah.
Anderson had hoped to unite New Yorkers behind a single moral agenda, but the imposition of prohibition on the city instead polarized the city.
Very much so, yes.
How did he wind up being convicted of forgery and sentenced to 2 years in prison? he seems like an upright man, even if...
It might be an example of what goes around comes around. You know, a lot of people have said that that Anderson was railroaded in the end. He angered enough people that someone was going to find a way to bring him down. So I'm not sure that he did everything that he was charged with, but they certainly, his opponents found a way to bring him down.
My guest is Michael A. Lerner, who's written a fascinating book called Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City, published by Harvard University Press. A number of reviewers have not only praised it, but have expressed amazement that nobody had thought about writing a book like this before, because it really does reveal so much about our country and the things that it was going through at the time, and also the legacy with us to this day.
Yeah, you do see a lot of prohibition, I think, is the forerunner for a lot of the political and moral arguments that we're dealing with today in the United States.
But what did the 18th Amendment to the Constitution call for exactly?
Well, the specifics of the amendment were that it banned the manufacture, sale, and transportation of alcohol. You'll notice what's left out there is possession and consumption. So from the very beginning, there were loopholes in here that were a problem. It was unenforceable, and a lot of critics saw that from day one and warned that it was going to lead to a mess. It's a real credit or a testament to the power of the lobbyists who got this passed. They knew what they were doing if they could get this in the Constitution.
The Volstead Act was supposed to implement.
Yeah, the Volstead Act was the enforcement act, and then various states passed other laws. New York had something called the Mullen-Gage Act, which was the state-level enforcement.
And they added to it. They refined it.
Yeah, you had the amendment allowed for what they called concurrent enforcement. So states and cities could sort of add on to the federal law.
But this sounds like some other things that we've engaged in, where we've gone in saying we're going to fix things up, and then now we're here. What do we do?
Yeah, unintended consequences. People don't see, you know, where this is going to lead. They haven't thought out the effects of this.
Including who was going to enforce it. So who was asked to enforce it?
Well,
it's a federal law.
It's a federal law, and the Bureau of Prohibition was created to enforce it. It was part of the Treasury Department. I figured they collected alcohol taxes, so it made sense to keep this in the Treasury Department.
No taxes anymore.
No, the taxes were gone, but you had a new bureau in place to police. You still had the manufacture of alcohol for medicinal purposes, for industrial uses, so they were supposed to oversee all of that as well. But for New York State, for example, the Bureau of Prohibition had about 200 agents to police the entire state, and it doesn't take long to figure out that's not going to work.
Now, they stuck poison in the medicinal alcohol,
yes.
And when people still made bootleg liquor using this poisoned alcohol, they increased the levels of poison in it,
right.
In effect killing off Americans.
Yeah, killing people for drinking, basically, not recognizing that people's habits were not going to change so easily. And being rather reckless with the way they went about trying to get them to comply with the law.
How long after the amendment was ratified did New Yorkers start finding ways to rebel?
About 2 hours. Really, the first night you started to see examples of New Yorkers looking for ways to undermine or to evade the law. This was just something that was not going to work in New York.
Is this just New York, or is this all over the country in big cities?
It's all over the country in big cities, but it's also in rural areas. You know, alcohol has been part of American culture and American life since day one, and to think that you're going to sign a law into effect and suddenly have people stop drinking just wasn't going to happen anywhere.
Would you say the legal system was demeaned by prohibition?
Absolutely. Judges were furious. They felt like they'd spent their careers trying to get to the bench, and then suddenly they found themselves being liquor cops and having two-thirds of their caseloads taken over by prohibition cases.
And you say that prohibition raids were, I'm quoting, marked by blatant displays of religious intolerances, class bias, and outright bigotry.
Yeah, the enforcement of the law was targeted towards the groups that were seen as the ones that didn't fit in, the ones that needed to be reformed. You left well-to-do New Yorkers alone. You left the old stock Protestants alone. You went after the Greeks, the Irish, the Italians, the Catholics, the Jews.
So the wealthy people were more likely to be able to get the booze, get good stuff, in fact.
Sure.
And nobody cared.
Yeah, they weren't seen as the group in need of reform.
Or a threat to society.
Right.
Alcoholism amongst the rich doesn't lead to crime.
Theoretically, yeah.
It's interesting that other people were also supporting prohibition, like tea merchants and soda fountain manufacturers. Did their businesses increase as they had hoped?
Not as much as they had hoped. I mean, a lot, you know, this is New York we're talking about, and that's one thing about New York that hasn't changed. Where there's a dollar, you've got someone trying to figure out a way to get it. So all sorts of people were looking for ways to cash in on Prohibition. Would movie tickets go up? Would theater box office go up? Not much of that played out the way they had hoped, though.
I would think that it would have hurt the economy of big cities especially. There was a major loss of tax dollars, not only in the sale of liquor, but all the other things that go with it, restaurants, places near where people drink.
Yeah, it was so complicated, though. I mean, you can certainly go down a whole list of places where the economic effect was negative, and Dries and Wetz would argue back and forth for the entire decade as to whose statistics were more meaningful, who was more, you know, more adept at figuring out who was suffering and who was gaining under Prohibition. But there certainly were costs to the city.
Some of the people who were gaining were corrupt cops.
Yeah.
The organized crime, which really got going here and way after Prohibition was over, still just found other ways to keep going.
Right. Prohibition gave organized crime in New York and other cities the foothold it needed to establish itself permanently.
You talk about some of the people who started out dry but then became heavy drinkers, Robert Benchley, Dorothy Parker, for example. What led them to change, and how important was the zeitgeist? After all, this was the period that's called the Jazz Age,
yeah,
where we have flappers, and we have, you know, we have this new music. We have a new sense of sexual morality.
Right. I think Benchley, in particular, is a really telling example. Here's someone who supported Prohibition, came from a temperance household, never drank, and then suddenly he's surrounded by colleagues who are going out to these exciting, fun, lively night spots, and he couldn't resist the allure. And and this happened for a lot of people, that drinking, by being by banning it, you made it more appealing, you made it more thrilling. So you know, a lot of people went for that.
Did it put the women's movement, if we can call it that, at odds with itself? Because many of the leaders of the temperance movement were women, and many of the leaders of the anti-temperance movement were women, saying, wait, we're liberated. We should be able to drink just like everyone else.
Right. It's interesting that in the 1920s, what you see coming out of the Prohibition debate is a sense that you can't really say women believe in one thing or another as a group, that it really divided women, and it gave women chances to be very vocal on either side of the debate, but it really broke the stereotype that all women were reformers or they all believed in a certain type of moral behavior.
And the largest repeal group in the nation was the Women's Organization for National Prohibition Reform, coming out of New York. So, the most prominent figure for repeal was former Governor Alfred E. Smith.
Mm-hmm.
So, was New York really the beginning of the end for Prohibition?
I think New York really led the way in the downfall of Prohibition, both in the way New Yorkers resisted the law. I mean, they just refused to go along with it.
We were drinking more than we did before, didn't we?
Well, it's really hard to tell. The statistics are so unreliable. I mean, drinking did not go away, and you can get all sorts of different takes on how much it went up. It definitely went up, but you know, how much is hard to say. But everyone in the United States could see that New York was disobeying Prohibition and having a great time doing it.
Now, after repeal, there were still some parts of the country that continued to remain dry. I don't know if there are any anymore.
Sure, there are still pockets, dry counties. There are no states that are completely dry. But what the end of Prohibition meant was that the regulation of alcohol went back to the states.
There were people who really saw this as a civil rights, an individual rights issue, didn't they? That
sure.
That the government couldn't tell them what to do, what not to do. Probably drank more than they should have as a result.
Yeah, there were people who said, you know, this is just an issue that the federal government should not be involved in. It should stay out of people's personal affairs.
So for the only time in U.S. history, an amendment was created to rescind a previous amendment, the 21st Amendment.
Right.
What did
it
say?
It simply said the 18th Amendment is hereby repealed.
And that's it.
That's pretty much it. There might be a line or two else about, you know, how it's passed and this and that. But really, it just says the amendment's repealed, and hopefully we'll never see another situation where we have to repeal an amendment. I think that's one of the greatest lessons of the era.
Michael A. Lerner's book, Dry Manhattan, Prohibition in New York City, is published by Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.